is Liz Gleeson, and you're listening to Shapes of Grief. Shapes of Grief is a curation of stories from ordinary people on their experience of loss, how their grief impacted them, and what helped them to find their feet again. Loss can really have such a profound effect on our lives, and it is my hope that Shapes of Grief will provide comfort, hope, and inspiration to our listeners, so that together we can get more comfortable talking about grief. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a patron of Shapes of Grief on patreon.com. This is a listener-supported podcast, so please do donate, like, share, and review. It really does keep us going. For more grief resources and grief support, find and follow us on all the usual social media channels and on shapesofgrief.com. So, Gary, thank you so much for joining Shapes of Grief.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It is such a privilege to have you on. And I'm guessing this is a whole new world for you in recent months.
Coming up 18 months ago that I was widowed. And, obviously prior to that, it's not something you really think about. I mean, I lost both my parents about 30 years ago. I was quite young and I thought that was tough. By the time I was 31, they both died. So I thought I'd done the grief thing for a while. And then losing Joy so unexpectedly back in October 2017, suddenly brought this whole new world of what all that was about. Yeah, so it's an interesting journey.
And it's still so early days. I mean, it's not even been 18 months.
No, that's right. It feels like forever, but also feels like yesterday. I mean, people say to me, gosh, it's still so recent. So much has happened, it doesn't feel recent. Because having to sort of, deal with the kids on a day-to-day basis. And this crazy thing, I was thinking about this the other day. My little boy, he's going to be 9 in about a month and a bit. So he was 7 when she died. This October, when it comes to the 2 years, that's nearly a quarter of his life that she won't have been there. That's extraordinary. That really made me stop and think, that sort of the way time scales work, it's nuts.
And especially when you're thinking about a child and that child's mother, and she was such an integral, she was the centre of his world, I imagine, alongside you.
Huge, yeah. I mean, very close. We've always been a very close family. And yeah, she was a very... she's a really good mum. I mean, amazing. And it was that typical thing of when we were expecting the baby, she's like, I don't know what to do, I'm not ready, I can't, I'm going to be awful. And from the moment they arrived, she was absolutely brilliant. And they loved her to pieces, So obviously when she died, it was a huge, huge blow to us all, But having them to deal with on a day-to-day basis and just get on and still try and have my work and all that, it makes so much happen in that time that it just feels... so long, but it is, as you say, less than 18 months. That is, I was talking to a grief counsellor the other day. I was doing a talk at a hospice about this, and they said, in our terms, 18 months is nothing. And I was like, okay, right.
The early days, absolutely.
Yeah.
You said Joy was a brilliant mum, Gary, and I imagine something that's very important for you maybe is to keep her memory alive. The children, because they are so young, can you describe a little bit what brilliant mum means to you?
Well, in practical terms, she was just so so competent. I mean, she just knew what to do in any situation. Whatever came up, she just seemed to know. And I used to turn around and think, how do you know all this? We didn't go to that. Did I miss the note about this? Did I miss the training course? When did this happen? I think the main thing was she just surrounded them with love without smothering them. And she always knew how to spin the positive on any situation, and was just so there. And they knew that if they needed anything, they could just turn to her and it would be there. Yeah, and me. But in real terms, she had the lion's share of it because, I was working flat out. And luckily, I worked from home, so I was a very present father. which meant when this did happen, it wasn't as huge a shock to the system in terms of our day-to-day practical running of life. They were used to me being around. I knew how to do the school run. You know, I used to do that from, you know, so I was very lucky in that respect. I wasn't one of these dads who went out to work and suddenly my whole life was turned upside down in that way. It was turned upside down emotionally, obviously, but in practical terms, the biggest change was I suddenly had to learn how to cook. You know, I mean, well, I used to cook years ago, but I hadn't cooked for years because, again, she was brilliant. So she just used to sort of, like, I'll do that, you know, stay away from the food. So just little practicals like that, you know. But it was just the efficiency with which she did everything and the warmth and love with which she did everything was just the thing that made her so special, really. And always with a smile, always smiling.
And I think from listening to you in previous interviews you've done, Gary, it's that warmth and love that really comes through when you're talking about Joy.
Yeah. Well, I every morning I used to wake up and realise how lucky I was. And I used to think to myself, you know, when's the day she's going to wake up and think, what have I done? You know, one day she's going to come to her senses. You know, luckily she didn't. You know, I was just very lucky. We had 19 years together. I was older. I never thought for a minute that she'd be interested in someone. You know, so to have somebody like that fall in love and have such a fantastic time. I mean, we had, you know, it was sickeningly perfect. It was wonderful. So I was just incredibly lucky. And it's one of the things that sustains me now is that I try very hard not to grieve for what I've lost, to look back and go, oh, I haven't got that anymore. And, oh, she's only got this. I look back and I'm grateful for what I had rather than resent what I've not got, you know.
That's really amazing that you can do that.
Well, I mean, it wasn't anybody's fault that it happened. You know, the universe decided, you know, to take her away from us. I can't change that. So there's no point in going, oh, no, you know, what am I going to do? It's like, Sean, I cannot change that. It tore my heart in two. And it, you know, that love is always going to be there. But I can't bring her back. So the only way to respect her memory and to carry on the goodness she did is to go forward positively and to have, and to, you know, it's my turn to have her smile. You know, I have to be that person. Now, I'm not as good at it as she was. I'm still grumpy dad, but it's, you know, I have to sort of go on how she did. That's the way you honour her memory.
I love that. I love that. It's like you're taking her legacy of love and kindness.
Yeah.
You're taking that on and you're going to bring that forward into the world.
Completely. It was a conscious decision, you know. I mean, it wasn't that difficult a decision because she just carried it with her, you know. And one of the things a lot of people say to me since she died is, you know, they just say, oh, she just used to walk into a room and it was her smile, her laugh is what they miss and remember. And she's one of these people that just smiled at everybody in the playground at drop-off, and people who barely knew her were sort of coming up to me saying how much they missed her. And, you know, it's that about her that was so good. And you try so hard to be that person. And it's what I always say to the kids, you know, if ever you've got a decision to make, just think what would mummy have done, you know, and do that, because she's invariably right. And the other day, Lily was having one of her nights where she was a bit tearful, and she has big thoughts. She's a little girl with big thoughts. She's quite a bright girl, and she's 11 now, and there's a lot of stuff going on when you're 11. And she came downstairs crying. This is a couple of months back now, I suppose. And I said, right, what is it this time? Is it the usual, you know, worrying about death and just the future? And she says, yeah, I was thinking, what's the point of life if you're going to die anyway? I was like, oh, that's a big one. Thanks, darling. Yeah.
So she's having an existential crisis at 11.
Yeah, bless her heart. So yeah. I said to her, I'll tell you what the point is. I said, you remember how now everybody talks about mummy and they say how wonderful she was and how knowing her made their lives better, and they miss her smile and they miss her positivity and just being that person who made other people's lives better simply by being them. That's the point. Be that person and then that's the point of life. And she was like, oh, okay, yeah, cool with that. And her crisis went away and she went back to sleep, and you know, it's fine. So yeah, it is, it's that positivity is what I carry forward, and it's what sustains all three of us, really.
It's become a need and a must.
It really has, yeah.
Profound loss can rock our inner world. It's confusing, life-altering, and often scary. You've probably already figured out that there are no stages of grief. But are there other models, theories, tools, or practices that can help us to navigate the grieving process? To learn more, visit shapesofgrief.com. As Liz says, the more people who are grief-trained, the more supportive and compassionate our society will be. And that will make life so much better for anyone coping with loss and grief. Now, let's get you back to the podcast.
And when I think about her, most of the time I think about her smiling. I don't think about, you know, yes, there are moments you're alone and you're thinking about the end. You know, you think about how cruel that was. But I, if I'm honest, most of my thoughts of her are thinking back to the smiling, laughing version of her. Which is a really nice position to be in. I'm lucky that I have the type of personality. I'm not a depressive personality. I've been very lucky in my life. I've never suffered from depression. I know I've got lots of friends who have, and it sounds awful. And I'm just very lucky that I'm not that kind of person.
Wise also, because you said you made a conscious decision to bring forward the love, the joy, the gratitude. There's no better legacy really that somebody can leave, that their loved ones will go forward with love.
Yeah. The grief is there, but it's a permanent sort of sub program that's running.
Yeah.
You know, and you can accommodate that into who you are and how your life goes, and you know, that is what it is now. You know, there is this underlying emotion that sits there the whole time. The loss, the fact I lost her. And you know, I can be as positive as I like, but the fact is she's gone and I lost her. But I've made my peace with that feeling, and I can push it back when I need to do other things, and I can invite it in when I feel like I need a moment. And there are times when I'm sitting there in the evening and I'm watching a TV program or films like that, and then something will happen in there that's emotional or will strike a resonance. And at that moment, I can just sort of throw my arms open and say, come on then, and let the grief come back in. And I can have a good old cry. And then I can say, right, we're done now, go away again. And I can get on. And I've got a relationship with the grief now that I'm in control now. I feel that that control is not to now get rid of it, because I feel it's an important part of what I've become.
I love that. I love it. I have this image of you driving the grief van. And I think for a while we're a passenger and, you know, we don't know where we're going and where it's bringing us and what's going to happen. But at a certain point, you know, like you said, you've made some conscious decisions. We can decide to step in to the driver's seat and take hold of it. And, okay, it's still here, but I'm taking the controls.
I liken it to one of my early doodles. Well, when it was about 9 months in, I think I did three stages of the grief demon, and it was on my back, this huge winged demon with its hand in my chest, and then it was standing beside me with its arms around me, and then it was beside me like a. There's a stage four now, which I'm on, which I didn't draw, but will come out at some point in one of the drawings, where it's now paced behind me with its hand gently resting on my shoulder, and I can most of the time I can just think, just leave me alone for a minute. But then every now and then it just gives my shoulder a little squeeze to remind me it's still there. And I can say, come on closer. And so it's there, but it's just following obediently now. That's kind of, you know, my one. I personify it, I think.
It sounds like you've really befriended your grief in a way.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a good phrase. There's no point in fighting it. And I said this to the kids right at the beginning. I said, you know, we've all lost our pain. It's broken my heart. You know, we've lost her. I'm going to cry. You're going to see me cry. I'm not going to hide anything from you. There will be times when I'll be useless. Just, you know, if you get embarrassed, fine. If you don't, you know, give me a cuddle, whatever. You cry when you need to, I'll be there. I'll cry when I need to, if you're there, you know, cool. And they've been brilliant about that, you know. And actually what that meant was I didn't as often, because I had the permission to do it, meant because I wasn't fighting it, it didn't come out in that way. If you're fighting grief, if you're fighting any emotion, it fights to break through. If you've allowed it in, quite often it goes, oh, no, you're fine. I'm here, but I'm not gonna fight you. And so it came out when it needed to, but a lot of the times it would just sort of sit there and it would be very, it would manageably, because I'd let it in. Do you know what I mean? It's quite hard to explain.
Absolutely.
That.
No, I get it. And it sounds like you're letting it be a subplot that's constantly there in your life, but you're not allowing it to be the main theme.
Yeah.
And I think something you said there, it's like, you know, grief can be painful, but often when we don't allow ourselves to grieve, that's what causes tremendous suffering. Yeah. And suffering and grief are different things. Grief is sadness. It can be overwhelming and it does move through us like the weather. And then we can get on with our life again. But when we don't let it come through, then we face tremendous suffering.
Yeah, I mean, there's that lovely, it's quite a well-known quote or whatever, but I came across it fairly recently, and I like it. It's like grief is basically the love that's left over. You know, if you didn't love somebody that much, you wouldn't grieve. So the grief is the love you've got left over for the person. You know, and I think that's the sign of grieving is a sign of love. So that's kind of comforting as well. And I've been lucky that I've got the doodles as well, and I've right from day one they've been a thing for me to vent the grief and to sort of get it out, you know. So I had this, you know, I made this decision to carry on. I was doing them for about a year and a half before Joy died. I was doing them as a diary anyway.
But for listeners who aren't familiar with your doodles, will you take us back to why you started that, Gary?
Yes, of course, yeah. Well, I'm an artist anyway. I mean, I'm, you know, a professional animator and director and artist, illustrator, whatever. But these days, the bulk of that work is done digitally. So I'm an artist anyway, and I'm drawing all day, but these days the bulk of it is digital. And I was missing just drawing on paper with a pen. So I said to myself, right, I'm going to draw every day just for practice. And I thought the only way to make sure I do that is to do it as a diary. If I do it last thing at night every day, think about something that's happened and do a drawing. And so that's what I did. And for a year and a half, I was just documenting our lives and funny things that I heard or that happened or whatever, day to day as a drawing. And I set myself rules. No sketching first, straight in with the pen, no more than 15 minutes, you know, just immediate drawings. And then when she was taken ill, I was in Vancouver on a business trip and I had to fly back early to try and get back because she was taken to hospital. But she died while I was on the flight. So I didn't do a drawing that night because it was an overnight flight. But the day I got home and found out that she died, when it came to bedtime, I thought, I've got to do something. I've got to draw still. I can't not do my drawing because it's what I do now. So I drew the broken heart. That was all I could draw. But then the next day, I'd had time to process a bit more and the drawings began again. And the drawings became a mixture of expressions of where I was in my grief state, an observation on something that happened that day in practical terms, or something funny that had happened with the kids, because this is the thing that I've also found so important, is that humour continues. You are allowed to laugh when you're grieving. And I think some people think, I'm grieving, I can't be happy. And there were times when I would be happy and then the grief would hit harder afterwards because you felt guilty being happy. But I came to realise, no, you have to allow yourself to be happy. Because, you know, because it's the love thing again, isn't it? You know, and you've got to. So the doodles became this, and they became this daily, like, self-therapy of what was going on. And so that was very useful to me, to help me process, because I was actively having to think about it. Rather than just experiencing it, I was then processing it. How do I put this into an image? And having that thought, I think, really helped me process the whole thing. And it's something I encourage other people. I mean, over the last few months, talking about grief and things seems to become a thing I'm asked to do quite a lot now. I've done talks at hospice. I did a Marie Curie thing the other day. And that's a great honour, actually, to be asked to do that. It's an incredible thing. I've come to realise that I do have something to offer, I guess. And one of the things I say to people is, you know, if you can find an outlet for your grief, a creative outlet for your grief in some way, not everyone can draw. It doesn't matter. You don't have to draw. You can draw. You can paint. You could bake. You can jog. You could box. You can build shelves. You can, you know, whatever it is that you like to do that's in any way creative, channel it in some way. And I find that very helpful.
It's so important to find an expression for your grief.
Yeah.
Nearly everyone I would speak to, they have found some way, like you said, a lot of people find it through sea swimming or they take up running. But it's so important to find an outlet to express your grief, whether you're drawing it or sweating it. Find a way. Gary, since Joy has gone, I mean, you've said that a lot is similar at home. You know, you worked from home anyway. But has Joy's death changed the way that you parent?
It has, in as much as when she's alive, despite the fact we're a very close family, you're still very much mummy and daddy and the kids. And again, very early on, I said to the kids, I realised it, to function, we have to be more of a team. I can't just be this authoritarian father figure. I can't just be daddy and the kids, although I am still daddy. But we are now a tighter-knit team. There's this, you know, I involve them. I mean, they were coming to an age where they would need to get involved more in stuff anyway. And I think that would have naturally happened. But I include them in the processes of day-to-day living a lot more. Oh, just go and do that, do the dishwasher, help with the laundry, do this thing, come shopping, help make a decision about what we're going to eat. You know, when you're the parents, you're very much a case of bringing them up, sorting them out, trying to find the things, you're nurturing them and all that. Now I've had to sort of say, guys, we're all in this together, come on. So we've become, although I am still daddy, they feel more like little mates now as well. We have become this Team Andrews, you know, we are a little team.
You have the glue of your grief that's keeping you together, and you're all experiencing that at the same time.
Yeah, and kids are extraordinary how they process the grief as well. They live in the present. So I've said this in many interviews, so I apologize to anyone who's listened to the others as well, but when I first told them that Joy had died, it was this raw, painful grief, horrible. And we held and we cuddled and we cried. And then the next thing they said after that was, what's for tea? And you go, right, yep, got to feed them. And that happened. And then now they're living their day. She died on the Friday on the last day of half term. Can we go to school on Monday? It was like, no. If you want to go to school, can you go on Tuesday? Let the school have a chance to tell your friends that what's happened without you there, because they'll find it hard if you're there. Let's us have a nice day out and then go back on Tuesday if that's what you want to do, which they did. So they went straight back into school because they wanted to be in their normal with their friends. They told me, basically, by what they were doing, that they wanted normality to carry on for them as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Yes, Mummy had died. It was this huge thing. But it shouldn't be this huge focus around, Mummy's died, poor you, let's wrap you in cotton wool and change your life. It was very much, they wanted their normality. So I worked hard at trying to keep this equilibrium for them as much as possible. And the fact I was around before Joy died, you know, that meant that me being around then wasn't as weird a thing for them. What was weird was there was just the three, not the four. And that's what Lily said to me. I said to her, what strikes you the most, you know, about this? And she said, I hate it when we have to go to pubs and we book a table for three, not a table for four, you know, whatever. And you go, isn't it interesting the little things that hit them the most? So, but yeah, they taught me that thing of living in the now, which, you know, so you can learn from them. And I remember Ben, it was about 48 hours, so about 2 or 3 days after she died, I think, suddenly had this massive anger hit, where the injustice of the whole thing, where he was so angry that she'd gone. And he, again, I've said this before, but he just thrashed and beat up our sofa and pummeled the living hell out of it, you know, and then he vented it and it was fine. And about a week later, when they were in bed, I felt the anger rise up in me, so I did exactly the same. I thought, that's what Ben did, I'm going to do that. And I literally just, you know, luckily it's a big, strong leather sofa, it was fine. But it was, you know, that process of the way they just let it go. And then that was out, and then they're fine, in inverted commas. You know what I mean? They allow the grief in when they want to.
Yeah, children process it quite differently. They are in and out of their grief with more fluidity.
Yes, and it pops up every now and then.
So, Gary, I wanted to ask you about, you know, you said you've done many interviews, and I know you've done a podcast with Carrie Lloyd as well.
Yes.
Listened to that the other day. And you speak about your experience with such fluidity. Mm. Has it become like a story? You know, you're able to speak about it so clearly in your early grief. And I'm wondering, you know, how attached are you to the experience as you tell it?
Because I've told it a few times now, I guess, I can emotionally detach while I'm talking about it. Otherwise, I wouldn't get through it.
Yeah.
I still feel it very strongly. And when I'm talking about it, I can remember those feelings and events very strongly. But because I'm a performer as well, and I've done theatre work and I'm used to sort of public talking with directing and things like that. So there's a little part of me that I can separate out so that I can actually do this, which is where I'm lucky that, again, I have that facility. So with that and the drawing means I'm a person that can help by talking about it. I'm a storyteller. It's part of my job is being a storyteller. Therefore, I guess I can slightly step aside from it to get over what I need to get over. But behind all that is still the experience of it. So I'm telling a story that I know, that I've lived. So I guess, I don't know if that really answers the question.
It does, and I think it's important to say it because there will be people listening who are struggling to get up off the sofa and go out and see the light of day. And they may be feeling, well, what's wrong with me? Look at this guy. He's still working. He's got it together. He's talking about grief. But it's important to say that this is one aspect of you.
It's a combination of factors. You know, I'm certain things have come together in me as a person. The ability to draw, the fact that I'm a storyteller in some sort of way professionally, the fact that I'm a performer as well, are things that I've been able to sort of put together to articulate the story of the grief and the feelings of grief. I still have those feelings, and believe me, there are those times when I sit there and it feels overwhelming still. But those are the times where I then go, right, now I'm in control of this, and that's that other side of grief that I've managed to sort of, because I'm a positive person. But when I'm talking to friends about stuff sometimes, or people I've just met, and I'm telling certain parts of the story, there are still things I talk about that I still find it quite hard to hold it together when I am telling those bits of the story, and they come up naturally in conversation, you know. But in these situations, like doing the podcast and the interviews like that, there's like a little professional part of the head that you step into that space. So that's perhaps why it comes over that way. I would say to the people that are feeling that thing about not feeling they can get up in the morning, I totally know where they're coming from. And oh my goodness, you know, I have been there, trust me. What I would say to them is, if they get an opportunity to talk about it with somebody, either a professional, get the counselling if that's something you want to do. And Carrie Ann's a huge advocate of that, you know, or if you have friends that you're close enough to that you can talk about it with, please do. Because the more you talk about it, the easier it becomes to process, the more you come to terms with it. I'm not saying it makes it go away, but talking about it, it's like venting the pressure cooker. If you don't talk about it, you hold it in. That's what's tearing you up. Talk about it with whoever will listen, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm not being facetious. Talk to the dog, you know, whatever. Talk to the trees. I don't care. Get it out. It's a huge part of what's helped me through. I'm very lucky. I have friends who, because a lot of my friends are theatrical, I mean, they're used to people expressing emotion. And so I'm very lucky that I have friends who would let me just babble on at them, you know.
Because it is all consuming, especially in the early days and months. It is all consuming. And, you know, all you want to do is, well, not you personally, but, you know, a lot of us in grief, all we want to do is remember our loved one and speak their name and have other people tell us stories about them. Was that your experience?
Yeah, very much so. It was, and I found I was hard to shut up about it. You know, if people let me talk, boom, I'm off. I'm away. Boom, 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 boom. And the thing that I always have to hang on to as well, the thing that I often say to people when they're talking about this kind of thing is, of course, especially if we have a lovely circle of friends, they've been amazing with me. And the thing is, they've lost her too. They've lost that person as well. Yes, you're living it 24/7 because they were your partner, they were your parent, they were your child, they were whoever. But the other people whose life they were in, they've lost them as well. And quite often they want to talk about them to you. But in our society, we find it quite hard to talk to the grieving. We don't know what to say. And I was very happy to hear people talk about her because I wanted to hear about her all the time. So letting people open up to you. I had times where my friends would be crying about it and I'd be comforting them that we lost her, you know, and that's great. That's a good thing. Let your friends grieve with you.
It shows our common humanity and that, you know, grief touches all of us.
Yeah.
And we're not alone. We're not isolated, you know, unless we make ourselves alone and isolated.
Absolutely. And if you are one of the friends in this situation, ask, would you like to talk? May I talk about it? You know, do you? Yeah. And you may be surprised how often the person will say, yes, please do.
Yeah.
And then if they say, I'm not ready, then you can respect that and step back. Okay, let me know when you are and I'm here to listen. Or let me know when you're ready to hear me, because there's stuff I'd love to say about the person that we've lost. You know, open that dialogue, because every time I talked about her, it helped a little bit. Yeah, sometimes you'd be talking about it and you'd be sobbing and hard to speak because it's bringing back the pain. But each time you do that, it's letting that out of it. And it was just incredibly helpful. Talk, 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 talk.
And on that note, Gary, how important is community to you, or has it become since Joy died?
Extremely. I don't have a large family. I was an only child. As I say, my parents died 30 years ago. I didn't go to school where I live. So, but in the last, you know, from when I met Joy, we met at a little local theatre, and our friend circle is all people from there. And so it was a very joint friend circle that we had. And then, of course, the school was the newer part of our lives that became the other side of our community. Having the kids, we had the school as well, and the parents that we've met through that, and, you know, people we've met having the children. So, again, I'll say a lot of that was to do with Joy herself and having this sort of personality that made people warm to her so well. But they really rallied around me. And just in practical terms, it's incredible that our friends, and I recommend this to anybody who has somebody, if you're part of a group of friends and you have somebody who's become bereaved, what my friends did, and to this day, it's the most extraordinary thing, and it's really helped me, was within a week, they set up a WhatsApp group where a bunch of them got on this group, which they gave the delightful acronym of the Andrews Support System, or ASS. And and I wasn't allowed on it because they said, no, we're talking about you, not to you. And they set up this WhatsApp group for them to say, has anyone seen him recently? Anyone know how he's doing? But also for me, if I needed someone to look after the kids because of work, if I had to go and have a meeting, if I needed a sitter for an evening or whatever, I could just give them a list of dates. Like, give us a month of dates. Okay. I'd send them that. And they pass it around the group. And they go, yeah, I can do that one. I can do that one. I can cover that one. And that's still going. I don't abuse the system, but I know they want to do it. And the great thing about that was if they can't do it or don't want to do it at that time, they won't. But there's a bunch of people in there. So they are contributing. They are helping. And they wanted to because they'd lost her. And it was something they knew they could do to help. So that was extraordinary. And I would recommend to any group of friends who've got a bereaved friend, something like that has meant so much. Because when you're in that position, you don't want to ask. You feel like you're imposing to ask people. Yeah. Oh, I need help. I don't know what to do. I don't know if I could ask. Well, I feel weird. Is it? Well, friends who offer help, offer because they want to help. Take the offer.
The way it's offered is important as well. Like, that just sounds like a wonderful thing your group of friends did. A lot of us tend to say, let me know if you need anything. And we're placing the burden on the bereaved person to A, know what they need, and then B, ask for it. And really, even when we're not bereaved, how many of us really do that when we need help? We're not great at reaching out. So, you know, just to say, right, I'm free on Thursday, I can pick up the kids, I'm dropping in dinner for 3 nights next week, and I'll deliver your laundry on Monday. Yeah, you know, it's exactly the instrumental, practical things that are shown. Actually, research shows that sort of instrumental help can be much more beneficial than emotional support when people are in the acute stage of grief.
Well, of course, what was interesting is a friend who would come round and maybe babysit when I got back home would then stay for an hour or two with me when I was drinking a chat. And you get that amateur counselling time, you know, that moment of, it's kind of built into the help.
Lovely.
It's just, you know, and I'd get nights where someone rather than sort of contact and go, you know, they haven't seen me, I haven't needed anyone for a couple of days or whatever. They just contact and go, I see some company tonight. You know, and like, yeah, great, that'd be lovely. And they just come around, bring a beer or something, and we just sit and watch a movie together, barely say a word, and then they go home, you know. And it would be just having a person there.
Yeah.
You know, I'd nod off, and they'd sit there looking at me, having nodded off in front of the telly or whatever. You know, so, yeah, the person grieving does need the help, but they may not ask for it. So if you are in that position to offer it, I mean, it really was. So yeah, community in that respect has been incredible, and just that support. And of course, for me, what's happened on a personal level, which doesn't happen for everybody, obviously, is I've got this greater community online because of what's happened with the doodles going a bit nuts.
I've got this viral, say it.
Yes. Yeah,
I mean, I first saw them a very long time ago. And I sent them to an English friend of mine, actually, who's doing something similar. One of her twins died, you know, a few months after birth. And she was finding a way to express her grief many years later through art. I stumbled across your doodles and sent them to her. And that was, I think that was almost a year ago.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's been, I mean, it grew and grew and grew. And what's interesting, what's lovely, is there's this huge online community now that support. And, you know, like, I had a rough day the other day. I think I posted something because I was feeling a bit poorly or something. Something happened. And just the people saying, you know, oh, I hope you get better soon. Sorry to hear. But, and they, oh, you know, ginger and honey and lemon, all the little bits of practical advice that come in from people all over the world if a little thing crops up in a doodle or you know, one of the kids feels a bit under the weather. You just get this wave of genuine love from people saying, oh, bless them. I hope they, you know, and you just go, wow, wow. On those days when you're feeling a bit low, that massive, for me, you know, this is where I find the social media for me has been very positive. I've been very, very lucky. I know it can be a horrible place out there, but I think it doesn't have to be. And there's a block button, for goodness sake, you know.
I think you've hit on a really important point, though, Gary, as well. And it's something I see for a lot of single people, you know, or widowed people, that social media can provide that sort of encouragement or support or company where you can have a great social life and go and meet people regularly for dinner, for a walk. But there's still a lot of hours in the day where somebody who still has a partner by their side, you text them when something's going on, or you show them a picture, or you've got this constant connection, or you know you're going to have it later in the day. And when that's gone, there is quite a void there. And there's a place for social media where you can get a bit of support from the right people.
There were times early on when I would have the evenings when you're sitting there and you start crying. And you just, I can't stop. I can't stop crying. I'm just having one of those really bad nights. And sometimes I would jump onto the Instagram live feed when that was happening. And I became that person. I was like, I don't want to be that person who just, but I said, right, I'm going to do this. And I'd switch it on and I'd talk to the camera while I was crying and say, look, this isn't a cry for help. I'm fine. You know, don't panic. I'm just having a cry and I just feel very alone. The kids are asleep and there's no one here. I'm just, and you get the little things coming up at the bottom and people are watching you going, you know, we're here, you know, for you, you know, the little likes and hearts and things popping up, and you know that people were there listening. And yes, they're not sat next to you on the sofa, but suddenly you didn't feel as alone because they were going, we understand, you know, you're doing great, you know, let us know if there's anything you want, whatever. Just the support of knowing they were there. Are you sure you're okay? You know, and I could read them as it's coming out and live respond and go, yeah, I am fine. Don't worry, Sue, whatever it is, just, you know, whatever, you know. Do you need me to come over? No, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Yeah, I'm just having a little cry. I'm having a vent. If someone was here, I'd be doing it at them. And I could work my way through the tears. And they were there. So social media became this sort of portal into just being able to make a contact at those times when you felt alone. And it was incredible. I was, you know, again, very lucky.
You're doing wonders for men's grief because, you know, I know as a bereavement therapist myself, every time I get a call or a voicemail from a man, I'm like, yes, you know, come get the support, because traditionally men don't. The research would say that men are like instrumental grievers. Okay, what do I need to do? Get the practical stuff done. And that women tend to be more emotional grievers or intuitive grievers. But, you know, men also have this whole emotional side to them that often gets swept under the carpet, or for cultural reasons, we think it's not okay to show it. And what you are doing for other men who are grieving is phenomenal. Yeah, I'm human. Yeah, I've got an emotional life. And yeah, I'm not afraid to show it.
That's really nice to hear. I've never bought into toxic masculinity or male female roles. I'm not, you know, you can look at me and go, he's a sort of middle aged, beardy, very blokey looking bloke, you know, and I think that's helpful that this sort of stuff over someone who looks like me is really unusual. And as you're right, yeah, I think that does help. Yeah, I've never bought into that whole kind of thing. I find it very strange. It's like, God, it's. To open up and admit emotions is surely that is a masculine thing to do. That's a brave, you know, not brave, that's not the right word. And you've got to do it. And I've tried to encourage my children. I hate gender stereotyping. So, you know, I encourage them to do whatever works for them. And we have, as a society, if that traditional male thing, oh, there's a strong man and he's a protector and hides the emotions and, you know, stiff upper lip and all that bullshit. And it's like, you know, no, God.
There's an illustration in that. I want to see that.
Yeah, exactly. And it is, yeah, there's definitely that. I'll put that on my list. But it is, it's true. And yeah, God, you're much stronger to tell people that you're not feeling great than to sort of go, yes, I'm fine. And inside you're going, no, I'm really not. If you could go, I'm not fine, I'm in pain, that takes the strength. And I think I would respect anybody a lot more who would say that than who wouldn't. I think, but it's taken being in this position for me to realise that, I think. I mean, although I've always been somebody who's been quite open emotionally sort of thing, it's certainly gone up, been turned up to 11, as it were, since this happened. You know, it's, I cry at everything now, you know, but in a good way. I was never someone who cried at movies and stuff. Now I'm like a blooming tap, you know, it's ridiculous. But that's great. I mean, you know, bring it on, you know, why not? You know, I do get very emotional seeing stuff, and I kind of, that's a good thing, really. It's, you know, released, that tapped into those emotions. I'm trying to think of the right expression for it. I mean, I feel better for it. I feel more complete that I can do this sort of thing. It makes me feel more comfortable with myself that I can. That there's, you know, although I wasn't really bottling stuff up before, maybe there was a slight hesitation to be as emotional about things a lot of the time. And you know, the only times I can remember crying in the past sort of 20 years was with, like, you know, on my wedding day when I saw joy coming down the aisle, and the time when the two kids were born. You know, I don't remember, but now it's like, you know, a good episode of a bloody comedy makes me cry. You know, it's ridiculous.
And it's lovely you pointed out, because I think grief really is, it's like it explodes open the landscape of our heart, and it's impossible to love without feeling grief, and it's impossible to have a broken heart without also feeling gratitude and love. Everything comes, like, grief doesn't come alone ever. There's a range of other emotions that come in with grief.
That's yeah. Right. I like that.
How do you think your grief and this experience of losing joy so early, well, it's not so early in your marriage, but certainly way too soon, how do you think it will change you, Gary?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I'm a work in progress, I guess. It's changed me as much as it's made me emotionally more open. It's certainly made me live every day to the full. It's made me grab hold of life and go, you know what? I've always said it's not a dress rehearsal. You know, life isn't a dress rehearsal. You've got to live it. But now I'm practicing what I preached, you know, and you go, yeah, actually, you know what? It isn't dress rehearsal. You know, we weren't to know that she was going to die at 41 with no warning. You know, that's ridiculous. You know, we were always planning for me to be the one to go. I was 15 years older and a man. So statistically, we were planning for her being alone eventually. And to suddenly have that turned on its head like this makes you go, oh, to hell with this. No, this is, you know, life is living. Let's just do this. And I don't mean by that I'm suddenly jumping off buildings with a parachute and, you know, whitewater rafting every weekend. I'm not talking about that. But it's just things like, you know, when you're sitting there trying to do something and the kids are saying, oh, I want to do this, that and the other. And you normally go, no, can you just leave it for now? Just stop. I'm trying to, you go, yeah, all right, let's do it. You know. Let's just put this thing down that isn't that important, and let's go and do the thing that you guys want to do, because, you know, that sounds like fun, frankly. And not stressing over stupid little things, you know, it's hard, and I still do it. I still catch myself being grumpy dad and being the parent that's a bit of a negative mate. You know, oh, no, we can't do that because there's no time because, you know, we've got more important things to do. But then I do try and catch myself and go, actually, is there really more important things to do right now, or should we just have some fun and enjoy? And yeah, at times you have to do serious things, but it's not restricting us. It's opening up the possibility to these other things in life, you know. So
what you've described there, like, from, you know, you said before Joy died, you would think about certain things in your head, but then when she died, it's like you really felt it, like life is not a dress rehearsal. And I think it does that to us, doesn't it? It's like the embodiment of grief. We can know things cognitively as we go along in our lives, but grief is a real physical experience. It's like it really unzips us, and it's like we start living in our bodies everything that maybe we only knew in our minds before. And it can be a call to action.
Become more hyper-aware of everything. Everything becomes more sensitized. And yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a good observation. And certainly, a lot of things happen, you put through that filter. I mean, again, not in a kind of oppressive way, but just because of what's happened, where anything comes up, that's going to inform your decision. How your life has changed because of what's happened is going to inform that decision. And again, it's part of trying to use that positively and use what's happened to you to inform decisions in a positive way, to say, yes, this is not, oh, I've been thrown an obstacle, but oh, I've been given an opportunity. You know, here's a thing to do. Oh, I've not done that before. Instead of going, maybe I'll wait and do it another time, you go, no, let's do that. Let's do this. So, yeah, it kind of throws everything into a sort of sharper perspective, doesn't it?
I have another question for you, Gary. What aspects do you find difficult to talk about?
Long pause that you need to cut out while I work this one out. I don't know is the honest answer. I haven't really come across anything yet that I haven't been able to at least consider and talk about. I think because I've chosen to sort of tackle this head on, I've talked about some things that perhaps might have been harder at times. And I mean, perhaps sometimes I feel like maybe I'm too open and I sort of, you know, I talk about stuff too much. But to be honest, part of my deal with myself is to just be open. So the hardest thing emotionally to talk about is the circumstances in the first 2 or 3 hours of knowing that she died. When I talk about telling my children that she died and what that felt like and those sort of moments, those are the hardest things to sort of go into detail about and talk about, because those emotions still come back and hit me, and you know. But
I think it's important to say that Joy died very suddenly. She did not have a long illness.
There was no warning. There was no warning at all. I was away. I was talking to her on FaceTime 2 days that looked like flu. And on the third day, when I tried to call her, she couldn't come to the phone. They'd got the doctor round on that she got whipped into hospital. I got phoned up saying, can you get an early flight? It looks quite serious. By the time I got home, she was dead. It was within 12 hours of being in hospital, she was gone. And it was, you know, multiple organ failure as a result of sepsis. But there was no time to prepare because there was nothing we didn't know. So yes, it was this massive kick in the balls, you know, so people who've had a longer time to sort of come to terms with it have different problems to face. I'm not saying it's easier or more difficult for anybody in any situation. However expected or unexpected a bereavement is, it comes with its own set of issues. There were lots of practical things that were hard because of this, and just the emotional gut punch of it was huge. But I think the flip side of that is then the recovery sort of took, there was a perspective of that as well. There's this huge gut punch of recovery. And then you're right, I can't do anything about it. If you've had a long time caring for somebody that's dying, and that's a deep hole that you're in that you've got to climb back out of. And there's a lot more dark memories maybe that you've got to get rid of the last sort of run into it, that's going to take longer to shake off. I had nothing but good memories. Nothing but good memories. And then this one huge, just massive kick in the butts. And that was sort of get over a ball, because I equate it to a physical pain. If you, well, wham, one big kick, you're like, ow. And then you get your breath and you carry on. And you have the memory of that. But if you've had something that's been debilitating you, and then you're really bad, and then you've got to do that recovery of it all coming back again. Do you know what I mean? And I think it's the emotional equivalent of that. Yeah, definitely. Remembering about the first few hours and how that pain was is hard to talk about. In terms of the broader issues, I haven't found anything too hard, because I've just been a bit sherry. So
it's a great way to be. Gary, what are your hopes for you and Ben and Lily for the future? Have you got that far?
We're living in the now like kids do, and my hope is that the now goes on for a good while. I mean, if I'm brutally honest, I want to live long enough to see them become adults. I want to see them be grown, happy adults who are independent and don't need me. You know, I'm doing my best to keep myself fit and healthy so that I can be around as long as possible, because, you know, the plan was always that when I went, Joy would still be there, you know, and that's not the way it works. So yeah, my hope for them is I want them to be happy adults who look back at their mum with great love and gratitude for who she was, that they can perhaps look back when I've gone and say, yep, he did a fairly good job. This is where I get emotional now. This is what you said, what's difficult is this, actually. I think my wish is for them to just be well-rounded, happy adults. God, I don't know. It would be nice to think that they, you know, I know that Joy would want me to go on and find somebody else and be happy, and I'd like to think that, you know, at some point there will be somebody who could step into that role, you know, sort of thing. It takes a special person because they have to sort of remember that there's this huge love that is never going to die for somebody who was there. And people have to understand that, you know, that it doesn't mean that you're not going to love again. I equate it to when we had Lily already and then we got pregnant with Ben. I had this whole fear of like, how's it going to work? Because I love Lily so much. Am I going to have to give some of that to Ben? How does it work? Because what you then discover is this whole new well of love you didn't know existed. Suddenly you love twice as much. So what should happen is you'll meet a person and the love will come for them, and it's a new set of love that doesn't impinge or take away from the love you had before. So that would be nice.
They're taking on a family, Lily, Ben and Joy.
Yes. So I guess that's possibly a hope for the future, if you like. That'd be nice. But my main thing is I just want Lily and Ben to be happy, healthy, well-balanced grown-ups who feel that, you know, we did okay.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you are doing more than okay.
You
have a tremendous amount of love for those kids. And at the end of the day, that's all anyone ever really needs.
Yeah. They still drive me nuts. They're still little buggers sometimes, I tell you.
Love and presence. Well, this morning at 8 o'clock, I don't know if you can see me here. I'm in my kitchen with my laptop, and I was playing your video, and three of my kids, I have a couple of 9-year-olds and an 11-year-old. They were standing watching your video, and one of them had, you know, a little tear dripping down the cheek, and the other one went, "Yeah, we should invite them over to visit sometime." So. There's a warm welcome for you, your community across the sea, Gary. If you're in Wales and look straight across, you can see us.
Oh, amazing, amazing.
Social media, Twitter, grief. This is the nice side of it all. You know, all these lovely connections that can be made.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard of the movie A Love That Never Dies.
I haven't, actually.
Jane and Jimmy, they made a documentary, A Love That Never Dies, after their son, Josh, was killed in a car crash.
Okay.
They made a documentary in the years following their son's death, and they travelled all around the world interviewing people who had also lost a child and what that was like. And Jimmy is a filmmaker, and Jane is a psychotherapist. So together they put together this documentary to share their experience and have the voice of the grieving heard, if you like. And they've been running screenings of it. So he was a filmmaker. So just like you, he used his art to express his grief. They're coming to Ireland next week, actually. The Irish Hospice Foundation are running a screening of the documentary. And I contacted them, you know, to say, would you do a podcast conversation with me? And they said they'd love to. And anyway, after a few back and forths, they're going to stay in my house. They're coming for a few days and we're going to hang out together. And it's really nice that, you know, I think this subject is different to so many subjects, that you make connections, you make new friends, you meet people who care. And it broadens your world. It certainly has broadened my world.
Completely. Completely. Yeah. I mean, as I say to people sometimes, it's very strange. There's a lot to be thankful for. That a lot of good has come out of this one terrible thing. And you have to sort of embrace that. You have to embrace the good that comes out of it. Yeah.
So, Gary, on that note, where can people find you if they want to follow your viral doodles, which are wonderful, may I say?
Thank you. Well, if you look on Instagram or Twitter, you'll find me under @GaryScribbler. And you can follow me on Facebook as well, which is Gary Andrews. And the Doodler Day Diary is public. So my profile is private, thank you very much. But I'm followable as opposed to friendable on Facebook. But it's the same things. To be honest, you know, if you're Twitter and Instagram, you get the same pictures.
Don't make the mistake that I made. I put a tweet up on Twitter. I'm new to Twitter. I've only been on Twitter a few weeks for Shapes of Grief. And I put up a post today saying that I was meeting you. And I put the handle @GaryAndrews. And Gary Andrews replied, he goes, "Well, that's not me, but it looks really interesting." And for a minute I thought, who have I invited to do the interview? So there's another Gary Andrews out there. So you're a Gary Scribbler on
Gary
Twitter.
Scribbler. Yeah. Gary Scribbler, that's the one. And you know, I hope people enjoy them. I say they started and they continue to be basically personal drawings for me. And but I think that's what people like, is that it shows the universality of our existence. You know, that how you're not alone in what you feel in grief, but also if you're a single parent, or even not a single parent, just a parent, there's stuff in there for you. That it's not all about grief. A lot of it's about kids. A lot of it's about theatre, because I love that as well. It's just about day-to-day life, really. It happens to be informed in my case by the fact that I'm a widower. But hopefully there's a lot of smiles in there as well.
Yes, it's a lovely offering. Gary, thank you so much. It's been so lovely to speak with you this morning. I really appreciate it.
It's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. You never know, I'll be banging on your door soon with a couple of little children in tow.
It is a welcome with a heart and a half. It's totally genuine. So do take us up on it.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, Gary. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Shapes of Grief. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical or psychological advice. If your grief is making you unwell, please do go to your healthcare provider. Grief is a normal part of being human. You are not alone. Join the Shapes of Grief community in our private Facebook group and find more support and useful links on shapesofgrief.com. Until the next time, from me, Liz Gleeson, stay well.